Corey Kahaney, Jim Mendrinos, and Sean Eli, welcome to another session of Coffee in the Clouds with comedians. With comedians. How you guys doing?
Very well. Thank you for having us.
Doing great. Thank you.
Cool. So, first of all, we're going to go round robin, but we're going to go ladies first. Corey, who are you and what do you do?
That's not me.
That's somebody's sound effects.
I loved it though.
You know what? It was something I hate. But okay. Who are you and what do you do?
It sounds like it was a game show. I am a 25-year-old aspiring comedian, and I am a Taurus and I like cheese. No.
You don't like
comedian for a long time, long time, 27 years. And I live in New York City, and I pay the rent doing stand-up comedy.
Cool. Jim?
Yeah. The earth cooled, and I started doing comedy, or at least it feels that way. I've been doing this since I'm 19. I own a film production company in lovely Colonia, New Jersey, where we have a beautiful studio that someday the state of New Jersey will allow me to open once again. And... you know, it's been all about the arts for about a billion years for me.
Yeah, you started early. I started at 40, so you had a head start.
Yeah, I was too stupid to know that I should have more life experience.
I think it's hilarious that you basically in your life, jokes have paid for everything. It's the only job you've had.
Everything that I have that I love is because of comedy. Literally everything. All the relationships that I value, all the money I've made, it's all due to, in one way or another, stand-up. Because even the writing gigs I've got for television, I got them through my stand-up work.
Well, the question is, how many relationships have you ruined through stand-up comedy?
That's a lot. That's an awful lot of them, especially on a late show Friday. That's where comics get to ruin relationships for many people.
I didn't mean other people's relationships. I meant your own.
Please. I do that just on my personality. I don't need comedy to help me ruin a relationship.
He brought up a good point, though. The late night Friday show in a comedy club is what separates the men from the boys or the girls from the women, because it's the hardest show of the week to do. Everybody's worked all week and they didn't plan well enough to get in on the Friday early show. So they're going to the Friday late show. And they've been drinking all night, and they're tired, and they're usually young. And so you have got to entertain that crowd and not let them start talking. Otherwise, it's just mayhem, and the club will be very mad at you if you can't keep it together.
And the worst, and Corey knows this, because she and I are in positions where we're going up later in the show, and if there's somebody early in the show that lost control, That next spot where you have to bring them back, if you don't have the greatest MC, you're sunk.
Yeah, I have to say, I've been both a bad MC and a good MC, and I think it makes all the difference in the show, because you've got to get the audience. It's a weird social dynamic that you're basically saying to people, it's your job to sit in the dark and let somebody else drive the train, and your job is to sit there and laugh and not talk back, even though it sounds like they're having a conversation with you. So and then you've got to get used to that. So the MC's got to warm up the crowd and get them understanding how that works, even if they've been to comedy shows before. So I think if a show doesn't go well, it's almost always the MC's fault.
Well, the difference is there's great acts, and I mean great acts, who are lousy MCs. I mean just genius performers who can't MC, because it's about being selfless. It's about, you know, setting up the next act and making sure – you know, if Corey's going to go on next, she's going to need something different than Sean is, or I am. And the MC has to know the talent well enough to know what they need and be willing to sacrifice and get them where they need to go.
Well, I think what's interesting is MCing a new talent night where you've got a lot of new comedians doing 5-minute sets, and some of them, nobody starts out in life good at anything. You've got to learn things. So you've got a comic who's been doing stand-up for between, say, 0 and 3 years, and they're probably not very good, and some of them will turn off the audience. And the MC's job is to turn that completely around and get the audience ready for the next comic.
Yeah. There's some people that are really good at it. I'm not one of them. You are, though. Jim Mandrinos is, and Sean, you're an MC all the time.
Yeah.
So, and Corey, you're better than you think you are, because I've been on a few shows you've hosted. You know, you give. You just don't like it.
I hate it, yeah.
That's fine, too. I mean, you know, it's not my favorite job in the world, but when I take the gig, if I take the gig to MC, I'm going to MC. You know, I'm going to do it right.
Well, it's the hardest spot in the show, because you're taking a cold audience and going up and getting them going, and it's a lot easier to go later in the show when the audience has been laughing for a half hour. I did a show, Karen Bergreen is a really good comic and a really good MC, and I'm sure everybody here will admit Karen's funnier than I am. But I did a show a few years ago at a theater, and I said to Karen, hey, can you MC? I was gonna MC, and then I said to her, can you MC and I'll middle? And she said, sure. And I think I had at least as strong a set as she did, simply because she was in the wrong place in the lineup.
Well, a good MC makes a show great. Yeah. You know, a poor MC, no matter how talented the show is, brings it down. You know, I can remember the comic strip back way back in the day sometimes would put favorites on to MC as opposed to people who should be MCing. And I remember looking at packed lineups with, you know, Dennis Wolfberg and Joe Bolster and Brian Regan, and the shows weren't doing that well. And I'm like, this is all on your MC. All of this is on your MC. Because that lineup should be destroying the entire time.
Well, clubs should know better, but they don't. It's only really in America where the weakest comic at a comedy club is the newest one is assigned to MC, and it's the lowest paying gig. If you go to any, and I've worked in the UK, I've worked in Ireland, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and some other countries. And the MC is usually a headline quality comic that MCs, and it makes such a difference.
Mm-hmm. I was asked to cut together a small piece of tape for, believe it or not, crew members that are still trapped on a cruise ship. I'm not, you know, we're talking June 26th. They're still on a ship. And so Wow. The cruise line just said, could you just grab, you know, a piece of your set and put it together so we could have something to entertain them tonight. And I'm going through it, and I'm trying to find something that, how do I say this? You're not dependent on the English language. So I was going through a lot of tapes is my point. You know, stuff where I was more animated and somebody who's not, you know, who's a foreigner could enjoy. And I found one piece of tape, and the MC was so freaked out because I'm following Seinfeld on this show. And that happened to me a lot. I used to come into Gotham Comedy Club and follow Seinfeld because he liked to torture me, and also because I knew how to do it. I knew how to, to use a maritime reference, I could shift the boat in the harbor. And I just saw how nervous the MC was when they brought me up. And I kind of calmed down not only the crowd, but the MC. And I was like, okay, look, they know that I am a nobody compared to what you just saw. And I said, but you all need to understand, I'm here for the spot pay. That act is not here for the money. So let me earn my money. And there was something about making fun of the fact that Seinfeld was so wealthy and that I was there for my $35. That shifted the whole thing. The whole thing.
And when it's funny, because those nights can be magical. When I first started in comedy, Lucian first gave me the spots following Sam Kennison. Those were my first spots on the schedule. And he gave them to me because he said, and it's a direct quote, somebody has to bomb after him, might as well be the new kid. You know, and I'm all of 20 years old, so I'm grateful for any spot. You learn. You learn or you go away. And I learned by doing those spots. Those spots after the celebrities mean everything to a performer. That's when you know that you're starting to come into your own.
Is there anybody you couldn't follow?
In my career, there was a couple of people I had a really tough time following. Like, don't ask me why, but following Emo Phillips for me is just, you could guarantee that those clothes would be filled with sweat. And Emo's not the strongest guy in the world.
Right.
But for whatever reason, his energy followed by my energy. I also used to a lot, and I mean a lot, follow Dennis Wolfberg when he was alive. And Dennis was another one for me. I don't know now because I have more skills now than I did back then. But back then for me, when I followed him, you know, there were times where they said, okay, it's going to be Eddie Murphy, then you. And I'd be like, all right, I know what this is. Not a problem. But whenever I walked in and it was like, it's Wolfberg, then you, I'm there like, crap, really?
For me, it was Jim Brewer.
Was it Brewer?
Because Brewer, you know, especially with that Friday Late Show, Brewer played to that crowd better than any human on earth. I mean, he did so much time about coming home drunk and trying to get in your house with the door key. Remember that bit?
Yeah.
It was, you know, he was on the floor because he gave everything that he had to do the bit. I mean, literally, he was laying on the floor at the end of the bit, and the audience would, sometimes they'd be on their feet, which is very rare in a comedy club to have everybody up on their feet. And now, Jewish American Princess Corey Kate, although, I mean, that's not really how I was introduced, but, you know, it was not who they were looking for.
Well, it's hard. I followed Jerry Seinfeld. I followed Jim Gaffigan a bunch of times. I've never had a problem with that. Once in a while, a really high energy comic like Jessica Kirsten, and I followed her a million times at Gotham Comedy Club. I think the thing to do is just make sure the audience knows you're going to be have a totally different style and go out deliberately slowly. But I remember at an audition at a comedy club in New Jersey, I was following a guy who completely turned off the audience with horrible, horrible racism. And I thought they were ready to go beat him up. And then, of course, the MC just went up and introduced me. And all I had to say to unhostilize the audience was I just took the mic out of the stand and I just said, I'm not him.
Yeah.
That's all it took. But Jim, I remember at Gotham Comedy Club where there was a show, and you know, people say there's no such thing as a bad audience. That's nonsense. There are some crappy audiences. And we had Gotham uses good MCs, and the MC went up and did 10 minutes and really had a tough time. And then the opener went up and did 10 minutes and really had a tough time. And everybody else looked like they were quaking in their boots. But I saw you off stage and you just had this look in your eyes that said, I don't care if the first guy bombed. I don't care if the second guy bombed. I've been doing this for 20 years and I'm not gonna. And you went up and you killed. And it's the difference, I think, between having 15 years experience and having 20 years experience. You just have the attitude of, I can have confidence even where most people would be scared.
Well, it's also because you're also seeing what the, you know, I hate to put it this way, what the younger comics are doing wrong. You know, you go up there and I see them being confrontational or see them trying to out-scream the audience and they're like, no, they're getting loud, you get quiet, make them come to you. But I will still hold on to this, you know, and this has been true for me my entire career. I'd rather follow someone getting a standing ovation than follow someone who's bombing. Really would, you know, it's less work. The audience already is in a great mood. You just got to get them to your energy as opposed to the audience hates life and wondering what the hell they're spending their money on.
I remember introducing Jerry Seinfeld at Gotham Comedy Club a few years ago, and he wasn't listed in the lineup. It was a surprise drop-in, and I knew he was coming. I was running the show, and he'd actually called and said, hey, can I have a spot? And I'm like, absolutely. So they tell me Jerry Seinfeld is in the building. I hadn't seen him, but I knew he was there. And I go up and I say, you know, what I love most about hosting these Ivy League of Comedy shows is you never know who's going to pop in. Ladies and gentlemen, Jerry Seinfeld. And the audience goes nuts. And then, of course, the applause and the laughter dies down and no Jerry Seinfeld. And silence. And I know he's there. And I know he's right around the corner where they can't see him. And they're waiting. And then you could feel the hostility in the audience grow. And he was waiting for that because then he walked out to bigger applause than he would have gotten if he just walked out because he turned the mood of the audience around by first letting them get pissed off that they thought he wasn't coming.
The biggest applause I've ever seen anyone get in an intro was right after, I want to say 88, when the movie Easy Money came out. And I'm working in Connecticut and I'm closing a show at the Treehouse and I get a note on stage and it says, hey Jim, can you wrap up early? Dangerfield's here. So yeah, of course I'm going to wrap up early because Dangerfield's there. And like 5 minutes into a headline set, I'm like, good night everybody. Audience is wondering what's happening. And the MC just went up and went, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Rodney Dangerfield. And I've never seen it. And I've been on shows with Eddie Murphy. I've been on shows with Carlin. I've been on shows with you know, the all-time greats. I've never seen an audience go as nuts as they did when they introduced Dangerfield at that point. It was just, it was everything to that audience. And it's, as a performer and as someone who loves comedy, because I think we all start because we all love comedy, just to see that much joy come from the room, you're sitting there and you're going, yeah, I want them to do that for me someday. That's where I want to get to. I want that reaction when you say my name.
I actually started in comedy hoping to meet Corey Kahaney.
There you go. Well, you just got to go down a box.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah.
No, it's. I was curious though. Was he funny?
Yeah, he was. He was. You know, and we all know the stories of Rodney. When he went up sober, he was incredible. And when he wasn't sober, it was sloppy and difficult. But that night, he was working on something. I think he had a Tonight Show that he was about to do. The worst part was he only did 8 minutes, and then they threw me back up.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Yeah, Brad Axelrod, of course he's going to do it.
Of course.
Like, the chicks aren't out. You got to go back up. And they bring me back up. And luckily, they liked me. You know, but, yeah.
If only he'd been a few minutes earlier, that was terrible timing.
Yeah. You know, but, you know, well, there's nothing worse than doing half a set than going back up and doing the other half. But, you know, at that point, it's just like, took the gig, I'm taking the money, so this is the job. I was contracted for 45.
There's sort of an unwritten rule. Like, when I briefly worked at the Comedy Cellar, I only worked there for like 2 years. But when I worked at the Comedy Cellar, I often, on Sunday night, would host. And it was the best night to host because they finished at midnight. But I can't tell you how many times Chappelle came in at 11:40. And you know, look, it was Chappelle. It was always great to watch. It was always fun to bring it up. It was always fun to participate. But, you know, I can't tell you how many times I'd be there till 1:30. Because Chappelle wrote on stage. And so you had to sit there and let him do it. You know what I mean by writing on stage? You know, he came up with a few ideas, but he was fleshing things out on stage when he was writing. And
if you guys were not in the business, what would you be doing? What was plan B?
45 and a hollow tip bullet. There's no plan B for me. This is it. Yeah, no.
I mean, I had a career that I left to do this. I was a catering manager for hotels, and I did special events.
So how did it come to be? What happened in your life that you're doing this and not doing that?
Well, it's going to sound really crunchy granola-y, but there was a point in my life where I was just surrounded by this message, you should be a comedian. It was very weird. Like I had my head waiter was the co-check guy at the comic strip. One of my other waiters was Chario, and he worked at Dangerfield's. And I was dating a comic, and it was just like, it was in my face all the time. And people were always saying, oh my God, you're so funny, you should be a comedian. Oh my God, you're so funny, you should be a comedian. And my boss took me aside. He goes, you know, you're the funniest woman in food service. And I said, oh, thank you. He goes, yeah, no one's looking for the funniest woman in food service. And on a dare, you know, some of the people that worked for me, they sang. And there was a club called Ye Old Triple Inn. Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
So Ye Old Triple Inn had an open mic Friday and Saturday, every Friday and Saturday, comics and singers. And they were going to sing, and I came in and did my 5 minutes. Now, I had been dating a comedian, so you have to understand, I'd been sitting there in the audience watching him perform for a year. I was sort of writing my act that whole time. And I got up and I did my 5 minutes, and you know, I didn't die.
Yeah. Wait, so the comedian you dated for a long time, you were dating before you were a comic?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I just assumed you met doing comedy.
No. Matter of fact, I was very often his audience, like me and all my friends and all the girls that worked in the offices and whatever. You know how you had to bring people? We were bringers for him.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was, you know, and then of course it was not a pleasant surprise when he found out about it. He was not happy.
Have you guys successfully done anything with the internet? In other words, Zoom, you know, Zoom events, Zoom comedy, etc. Talk a little bit about what you've been doing, you know, since the pandemic.
I've been doing a lot of Zoom shows, and obviously there's a learning curve. Some of them go better than others.
Do you have the audience? Do you have the audience muted or not muted when you do those?
A lot of times when I've been booked to do a Zoom show, in other words, like an organization has hired me to do a Zoom show, I have to go with what they want. And I've had to do both. I've had to do the muted and unmuted. If everyone has to be muted, I take the audience through a tutorial and I say, okay, everybody, let's pretend you're getting a hearing test. You know how when you have a hearing test, you go like that? I said, I need you to do that so I know that you're laughing, because that's the only way. But I did a show Friday night. It was in California. I just was on much earlier than I'm used to. And they had a really interesting thing. The MC, who was really good, he took the audience through the tutorial of what to do and whatever. And he had everybody go to their audio controls, click on it, take their volume down to 30%.
Good idea.
And then we were all, everybody was unmuted. And occasionally I heard a dog bark. And but they managed, because the differential between the 30% and our being on full, their face didn't pop up when sound came out of them. And that that seemed to be a good fix. That was one of my favorites, because I actually did hear a laughter, muted laughter, but I heard, not muted, but, you know, dampened laughter.
Very good.
I find that the shows, it's brutal to do a long set on Zoom. The sweet spot seems to be 15 to 20 minutes for a headliner. I think 10 minutes is perfect for everybody else. I also think that if you have something prepared that you can lean on, it helps too. Like a prepared piece. Like I read a couple of Yelp reviews that were, they were just really funny, but it was about what it's like to get food, takeout food from this restaurant. It was basically an ungrateful person was complaining about the food in a pandemic. It was just very funny. But my point is, I had a tangible piece of paper that I was able to lift up, and it gave a different, it gave variety to the piece. It wasn't just me speaking straight to camera.
Yeah.
What about you? You done Zoom shows?
A ton of them.
I haven't. I've been resisting it, but I think I'm going to have to.
I've done a ton of Zoom shows, and I've also done a couple of the drive-in shows that people are doing now. Oh. And to stick to the Zoom shows. Really stick to the drive-in shows are horrible.
Really? But, I just pitched two of them.
Yeah, they're not fun. They're great for the audience. They're horrible for the performer.
What? Tell me how it works.
You stand on the back of a flatbed truck and talk into a microphone that is connected to an AM or FM transmitter. The people are sitting in their cars, tuned to that station, and when they hear something that they think is funny, instead of laughing, they honk. So the funnier you are, the more noise pollution you create. And you're literally like 4 feet away from the cars, so it's just like a barrage to your senses, and it's very off-putting for me, you know. Zoom shows, yes, I hate the silence, but my act is more of a storyteller, so I can fold into the stories. I've unfortunately done 2 1-hour sets on Zoom. You know, both times people, you know, hired me and we want an hour. And they're like, you don't want an hour. You really don't.
No.
And they're like, well, we're giving you this much money. And they're like, I'll do the hour. And the first time when I tried to keep my stand-up cadence, it was miserable. And then the second time when I just, because I do storytelling shows on occasion as well, when I just said, okay, this is a storytelling gig and I'm just going to relax and go with that pacing, it was fine. But for straight stand-ups, man, the Zoom shows are difficult.
I also found short jokes work better.
Yeah.
So if you can, my husband, you know, the Kindle joke is you know, my husband got me a Kindle. You know, I think when you give somebody a Kindle, it's like saying I love you, but not enough to buy you an iPad. Perfect joke. because they hear it, they process it, they laugh at it. I can tell that they've gotten it because I can see their faces and then I can hear the laugh. But when it's a joke that requires a lot of nuances.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're competing with the fact that, you know, they have Facebook and Instagram one keystroke away. So yeah. Probably half the people watching a Zoom show are not giving you their undivided attention.
Well, I'm just, you know, grateful that I'm not following Emo Phillips on any of these Zoom shows. That's what I'm grateful for.
I was just about to book you for a drive-in show with Emo Phillips.
Oh, God.
But I'm going to ask them not to honk. I'm going to say flash your brights instead of honking. I think that's better.
And the first comic with epilepsy that has a seizure will love you for it.
What about YouTube? What about TikTok? What about other technologies? Is anybody crushing it with anything else besides Zoom?
Not for lack of trying.
I have a sketch duo I do with a younger performer, and every Friday we release on Instagram, Instagram/New Media Comedy, and we average around 100,000 views a week, you know, which is nice. And you know, I've got stuff on Amazon Prime. I've got, you know, stuff I'm releasing. Like everyone else, I started a podcast in the middle of a pandemic, which is actually starting to oddly get some press, which is wonderful. You know, so I think we are all trying it. It's just varying degrees of success.
I got a question for all three of you, and we might wrap it up with this. If you had a niece, a nephew, someone that you actually love, someone that you actually, and they came to you and said, I want to be a comedian. I want to be a comic. Okay. And I remember you love this person, right? So what is the advice? What would you be heartfelt advice be given to someone if they said, you know, I want to be in the business? Corey, you first.
Well, if it was someone I love, then I'd probably know them. Right.
Yeah.
And I would really, really ask them if there's anything else they were enthusiastic about, anything else that gave them a lot of pleasure. I don't think anybody does this because they want to be a comedian. I think they do this because they have to be.
Got it.
It's very much, I hate to sound corny, but it's very much a calling.
Yeah.
This is the only thing that feels that I can fully express myself. Nothing else has felt that way. So
would you talk them out of it, or would you, at what point do you support them versus try to talk them out of it?
I think you try to figure out whether for them it's a calling, you know? And most of them it isn't. I've had a lot of, you know, people, more often than not, it's somebody's son. Could you talk to my son, Corey? And there's only really been one. And it was this, I think he's actually doing okay. Matthew, I can't remember his last name, but he went to Emerson. And he's doing really well. And he was one of my students when he was 17. Mm-hmm. And his mother said, you know, should he do this as a profession? And he was the one exception that I have to say it was a calling. But for everybody else, nobody can tell you you're not going to be a comedian. Because it's unfortunately something you have to discover on your own. Mm-hmm. You know, another person who really thought it was a calling had their first baby and they had to get a job. And it doesn't look like they're returning to the stand-up world.
Jim, what do you say?
I'm different than everyone. If this is what you love doing, then I want you to do it. You know, this business has made me absolutely miserable on occasion. Corey one time pointed out that there was about 5 years where I seemed to take off on stage. Said that to me on a cruise ship one time, and that was fairly accurate because it does break your heart. And there were 5 years where I'm like, fuck it, I'll just coast, you know. And then in 2014, I had it taken away from me for about a year and a half. And I realized that there's nothing anybody I'm in a relationship with is my mistress, and comedy is my relationship. And that's always been how it's been for me. So if somebody comes to me and says, this is what I love, you know, and I love them, I understand the amount of joy they're going to get from it. So I'm going to support it. I'm going to tell them how miserable it is. I'm going to tell them how unfair it is. I'm going to tell them what they're going to miss out on. You know, I rarely go to a friend's wedding. I rarely go do stuff with people on weekends. When I'm working, they're all free. When they're all free, I'm working. I'll tell them all the information, and if they say they still want to do this, all right, let me show you how to do it right. But, you know, because it's if you love this, and you do have to love this, Corey is 1,000% correct. This is not something you do because you like it. You have to love it. But if you love it, you get more out of this. That feeling of being on stage when a wave of laughter washes over you, there's nothing. And trust me, I've done all the drugs. And had as much wild time as you could have. But that feeling of that washing over you, nothing feels like that. Nothing ever will.
Sean, what do you think?
I agree. I think the greatest feeling in the world is just making people laugh. And I had a friend who just wrote to me. She said, I really love your Facebook posts. I wish I had your sense of humor. And I wrote back and I said, actually, I think a sense of humor like we have professionally is sort of like a swimming pool. You think you want one, but what you really want is for all of your friends to have one, because that's a lot easier. But if somebody came to me and said, I want to do stand-up comedy, I'd say, okay, give it your best shot. Just know it's a hard slog. It's really tough at the beginning. I think it is more of a meritocracy than, say, music or acting, because if you're really funny, people will notice you. You can be the greatest musician or actor in the world and still never get hired. Mm. But if you're a really good comic, people are going to notice. Now, if you're also a flaming asshole, it's going to be a lot harder. But I had a kid write
to me. Some of the most successful are colossal assholes.
Oh, yeah. I can point to a whole bunch of stuff happening on Twitter right now that tells you that's not true.
Yeah, I suppose.
I think it's an asset, Sean.
Well, the confidence that assholes have may be an asset, but there are people who won't get booked because they're jerks, at least when I put shows together. But I had a kid write to me a couple of years ago, and he said, listen, I want to be a comedian. Where should I go to college? And I said, well, listen, if you could get into Harvard, you wouldn't have written to ask me. So let's put that off the table. I'm going to give you advice that will sound like it's coming from your parents, but go to the best college you can get into. Unless you want to go to Emerson or another performing arts school, go to the best college you get into, because you're going to need a day job when you get out. And the more money you have, the easier this is going to be for you. And if you go to a better college, you're going to have more successful friends, and you're going to need them too. So if all of your friends are making minimum wage, they're not going to be coming to your shows and supporting you. And my mother told me something Jim said. My mother told me when I was a little kid, if you go into entertainment or you go into, let's say, opening a restaurant, you're going to be working when all your friends are out having fun. You're going to be working nights and weekends. Yeah. And unfortunately, that's something we do. But I think it's worth it.
Well, guys, this was fantastic. We're going to have links to your websites and make it real easy for people to find you. Just this week, we did a virtual event with 32,000 people.
Muted.
The future could be. The future could be. You know, we need a keynote. We need a warm up act. You know, so you never know what the future is going to hold for these Zoom events. Okay.
Yeah.
But guys, this was another session of Coffee in the Clouds with comedians. Take care.
Thanks. See y'all next week.
Bye, everybody.